Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, October 28, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. As Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat is very ill, Palestinians react to the Israeli vote to pull out settlers from Gaza. And we look at Ghana's interest in the outcome of the US presidential election. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Department of Defense must immediately stop involuntarily administering the anthrax vaccine, according to a judge's ruling. Heather Buckheim reports from D.C.
The U.S. Defense Department has been ordered to halt mandatory anthrax vaccination of soldiers. Judge Emmett Sullivan ruled that the DOD must comply with a congressional decision barring involuntary immunization with experimental drugs. The DOD insists that the drug is an effective means of safeguarding the more than 1 million troops that have been inoculated since 1998. Many who have been administered the drug complain that it made them sick. Christopher Shays, chairman of the House Subcommittee on Human Resources, has protested vaccination without consent and supports the ruling. Christine McElroy is Shays' spokesperson.
The DOD anthrax program is now voluntary, and until the FDA conducts a fully open process to evaluate the anthrax vaccine, service members must have the same rights as every citizen to decide what goes into their bodies.
Some troops who refused vaccination were punished, even court-martialed for their protest. Mark Zaid, an attorney who has defended service members on this issue, said that the next step is to ensure that all punishments are reversed. With Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Heather Buckheim.
The Seattle Police Department announced they will stop using a particular piece of equipment referred to as non-lethal crowd control while investigations are pending into the death of a Boston Red Sox fan. According to a report released yesterday, the officers in Boston who used the pepper pellet guns, killing one woman, were untrained in its proper usage. Chuck Rosina reports from Boston.
Last night, the Boston Red Sox won their first World Series title in 86 years. Thousands of fans poured into the streets in spontaneous celebrations. Police presence was in abundance. Gas canisters were used, and some arrests were made to control the crowd, but force was somewhat restrained. This after last week's celebration, when the Red Sox defeated the Yankees for the pennant, Boston police used an alleged non-lethal weapon, a pepper gun. 21-year-old Emerson College student Victoria Snellgrave was killed that night after being struck in the face from one of the projectiles. Snellgrave was among an estimated 80,000 fans who swarmed into the streets outside Fenway Park last week. Within 24 hours of Snellgrave's death, Boston Police Commissioner Kathleen O'Toole suspended use of the pepper guns. Several days later, O'Toole asked Massachusetts former Chief Federal Prosecutor David K. Stern to lead an investigation into the death. Two police officers, Deputy Superintendent Robert O'Toole, no relation to the police commissioner, and Patrolman Samuel Silter, are on administrative leave. The Boston Globe reported that some of the officers using the pepper guns were not properly trained. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina in Boston.
Colombian troops have killed a former U.S.-trained Colombian Army officer who had become a leader in the country's largest paramilitary group. From the Latin American News Service, Joe Gardner-Wesley has more.
Major David Hernandez had become a leader in the ultra-right-wing United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia after he murdered a state official while he was still an Army officer. The Associated Press reports that Hernandez died in a clash with Army troops on Tuesday. Human Rights Watch says Hernandez was one of at least seven graduates of the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, to have links with paramilitary groups. Paramilitaries are responsible for a majority of deaths and human rights crimes in Colombia's decades-old civil war. The U.S. Congress recently voted to double the number of U.S. troops allowed to participate in Colombia's war, while both major party presidential candidates have said they would continue to support Plan Colombia, the largest foreign aid and military assistance package in the hemisphere. With the Latin American News Service, I'm Joe Gardner-Wesley.
The European Union has decidedly rejected a potential new cabinet that included an outspoken critic of gay and lesbian rights and single motherhood. Deletta Varlese has more from Naples.
European Union Commission President Manuel Durão Barroso announced the reshuffling will be fast and limited after yesterday's vote was suspended. Monica Fassoni, an Italian MEP with the Green Party, said the successful pressure that blocked the candidacy of prejudiced minister is historic.
The left-wing managed to convince Barroso that his show of force could lead to a negative vote. Therefore, he withdrew the original team's composition and he'll propose a new one. That is something that has happened for the very first time in EU history, and there seems to be an absolutely positive result.
Previously, Barroso recommended former Italian minister Rocco Buttiglione to be the next EU Minister of Justice. Buttiglione is known for his negative public comments about homosexuals and single mothers. The Commission President declared he'll present a reliable alternative, but he left open the possibility of including Buttiglione once more. For Free Speech Radio News, Diletta Varlese, Naples, Italy.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Iraqi Prime Minister Ayad Alawi said today that Iraq can expect many more attacks before the January elections. His comments come as more than 90 suicide bombs have targeted foreigners and Iraqis seen to be collaborating with the US over the last 4 months. A new armed group has announced via the internet that they will behead the Japanese hostage in 48 hours if Japanese forces do not pull out from Iraq. Japan's prime minister says he will not withdraw his troops. And today a new report of the kidnapping of a Polish worker with a demand that Poland withdraw troops. Meanwhile, in what is seen as the second step in a plan to attack Fallujah, US troops have raided the neighboring city of Al-Ramadi. Troops have forcibly entered houses, saying they're searching for weapons. According to witnesses, the troops have bombed one house where they found explosive materials. The owner, with his three sons, were detained. There were also reports yesterday that in an aerial bombing of Fallujah, three civilians were killed. In Baghdad, meanwhile, a roadside bomb has wounded three US soldiers. With the violence careening out of control, FSRN's Salam Talib in Baghdad asked Mr. Salah al-Janabi, professor of political science at Baghdad University, how much of the Iraqi population was supporting the US occupation.
The Iraqi resistance represents the highest majority of Iraqi people right now. The latest research shows 92% of Iraqis are against the U.S. occupation of Iraq. I think all of these people will be part of the resistance sooner or later.
That was Mr. Salah al-Janabi, professor of political science at Baghdad University, speaking with FSRN's Salam Talib. Today in Washington, advocates for civil rights organizations gathered outside the Republican National Committee headquarters to demand the end of minority voter disenfranchisement and intimidation by the RNC. Dolores M. Brunal has more on this story.
The press conference was held outside of the GOP headquarters, just steps away from the Capitol. Leading members of historic civil rights organizations, such as the NAACP, the National Council of La Raza, and many others, spoke out against minority voter suppression tactics that the Republican National Committee used during the 2000 election and these recent months leading to Tuesday's election. Wade Henderson from the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights led the press conference.
The role of political parties in our nation should not include coordinated efforts to suppress the vote of minorities and individuals with disabilities. The right to vote is not a partisan issue. The right to vote should mean the right to vote for all Americans, regardless of race, ethnicity, religion, or disability. Today, we call on the Republican National Committee to cease and desist any coordinated efforts to impede the democratic process.
Civil rights organizers claim that Republican state officials have suppressed voters, particularly minority voters, in Oregon, Nevada, Florida, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Ohio. Also at the event was Hillary Shelton. He is the director of the NAACP office here in Washington.
Wisconsin Republicans have announced plans to initiate background checks, as they call them, on newly registered voters, an intimidation technique designed clearly to induce fear and apprehension on the part of newly registered voters, particularly in racial and ethnic minority communities. Ohio Republicans plan to place recruits inside polling places to challenge the credentials of voters they consider suspicious.
An estimated 40 million Americans living with disabilities are of voting age. And according to Jim Dixon from the American Association of People with Disabilities, 22% of them have been prevented from voting in previous elections. He is afraid that the same thing will happen this time around.
It is outrageous that a poll worker will say a person with a disability cannot vote because she thinks
that person isn't capable of making a vote. It is un-American. It is wrong for Republicans across this country to be challenging our right to vote. Yeah. This is wrong.
The Coalition of Civil Rights Organizers had written letters to both Democrats and Republicans demanding a response on these issues, but only the Democratic National Committee came forward to listen to the organizers, who say that their efforts to reach Ed Gillespie, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, by letter or phone, have been futile. At the end of the press conference, two spokespeople from the RNC gave brief statements to the media, saying that Bush is popular among African Americans and denied any claims of voter suppression or intimidation. Wade Henderson gave these remarks on the RNC's statement.
I think that the response of the RNC today was clearly a partisan response. They sought to put aside the issues that we had raised about actual examples of disfranchisement, of voters being blocked. And instead, they talk about policies that they are pursuing around home ownership and economic development and education, having nothing to do with the issue under conversation today. Instead of simply coming out, inviting us to come in, asking us to state our concerns in a reasonable manner, and providing a reasonable response, they've chosen to stonewall a legitimate inquiry.
Reporting from Washington, D.C., I'm Dolores Bernal for Free Speech Radio News.
A team of Jordanian doctors headed by Yasser Arafat's personal physician are poised to transfer the Palestinian leader to a Paris hospital. Late yesterday, concern grew for Arafat as he was having difficulty holding down food and is said to be very weak. This morning, his aides said that Chairman Arafat did not lose consciousness earlier today, but acknowledged that his health had deteriorated suddenly. Israel has promised to assist Yasser Arafat's departure from the West Bank for treatment, but has not given an undertaking that he can return. Meanwhile, outrage continues to grow in Israel's settler strongholds after the Israeli parliament voted for a pullout from the Gaza Strip of all Jewish settlers. FSRN's Awad Dwabiz brings us Palestinian reaction from Ramallah.
There are few Palestinians who follow with optimism the latest developments regarding the Israeli Prime Minister Sharon's pullout plan from the Gaza Strip. While the Israeli Prime Minister is struggling after his first victory in the parliament, which approved his pullout plan from Gaza, Palestinians expressed a great lack of trust in Israel's intentions and fear that the price of the partial Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza Strip will be high to pay in the West Bank. Qadura Faris, Minister of State in the Palestinian Authority and one of the main architects of the Geneva Initiative, expressed the official septic position.
Sharon's plan is more than a pull out of Gaza, and it started way before. By the construction of the separation wall, the expansion of the settlements, the total control over Jerusalem, and lately, the bypass roads plan that the Israeli Prime Minister is trying to implement. So the pull out from Gaza is part of a greater plan. These are the objectives of the plan. Nevertheless, the fact that an extremist leader of settlers like Sharon decided to dismantle this huge number of settlements is a great sign. And this is only the beginning of failures for this settlement project.
The Palestinian population has the same opinion. Reading the details of the pullout plan, Jibril Hijji, a journalist from Tulkarem in the north of the West Bank, thinks the only objective of the plan is to sabotage all efforts aiming at the creation of a Palestinian state.
They didn't give us any kind of the meaning of the state, like the borders. They're trying to stop to find the state of Palestinian because they stopped the roadmap and another political movement. I think there will be war and people will pay the price.
A price to pay with the continuation of violence in the Palestinian territories. Last week, 20 Palestinians were killed in less than 48 hours in Khan Yunis in the Gaza Strip. And the approval of the Israeli Knesset of the pullout plan seemed far from the daily violence. Lara works in a bank in Ramallah and hoping this pullout would be a first step towards freedom. She insists that Palestinians must never believe Israelis since Sharon always tricked Palestinians.
There's a trick as Sharon every time do. I don't believe anything Israeli make because always they trick Palestinian. Maybe it's a first step to be free. but we mustn't believe Israeli saying.
Yet, according to observers, the challenge of the Palestinian Authority will start once the Israelis withdraw from Gaza. Today, Palestinian Minister Saeb Erekat called for a direct coordination and a negotiation process between Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority for the handover of the Gaza Strip. But even if it is a unilateral plan, the Palestinian Authority will take control of any piece of land evacuated by the Israelis, according to Qadura Faris, who told us that without a direct international intervention, the conflict will never stop.
This is Palestinian land evacuated by the occupation. Consequently, the Palestinian Authority has to take control of it, and we are not afraid that any Palestinian faction or organization would try to impose its control by force. But unfortunately, the conflict with the Israelis has reached a stage of a total absence of any international direct intervention. This will lead to more violence.
According to political experts, the Israeli pullout plan will need much more than an approval by the parliament, taking into consideration the opposition to the Israeli prime minister from within his own coalition, which might lead to premature elections in Israel that would postpone the implementation of the plan, which means more time and more victims from both sides. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Awad Ebs, reporting from Ramallah.
With the U.S. presidential election now days away, there's considerable global interest in the outcome, especially so in Africa, where there's hope that the U.S. will take the lead in opening up Western markets to African goods and further supporting the continent's development. Rupert Cook reports from the West African nation of Ghana.
With presidential and parliamentary elections due in early December, Ghana's political parties are busy trying to win support from voters. Yet despite the question of their own re-election, senior Ghanaian politicians are following the electoral process in the United States with close attention. There's a common perception that the outcome of the US vote could have major implications for the immediate future of Ghana as well as across Africa. Kofi Attoh is a member of Ghana's parliament with the main opposition party, the NDC. He's also the ranking member of the parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee.
My preferences are more to the Democrats every time. I cannot hide that one. I know President Clinton had a lot of interest in Africa, and I can feel his sincerity. I do hope that if the Democrats win, if we still have that passion, you need to begin with that passion. You need to feel that you can do something about it. Then you begin to tackle the system slowly. So Senator Kerry should be my preference.
Nostalgia for the Clinton presidency is shared across party lines in Ghana. There's a strong perception that more attention will be paid to Africa with a Democrat in office. Kwabena Oduseh-Kwaje is a member of Ghana's parliament with the governing NPP. He's also the chairman of the parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee.
America sneezes and the rest of us catch cold. The type of leadership that America gets also for Africa determines how Africa is going to progress. When the Democrats come to power, the traditional attitude towards a minority, and for that matter, third world countries, it's more favorable. President Bill Clinton has declared that Africa is a place to do business. For instance, when Bush came to power, the attitude was President Bush was that he was going to explore and see whether Africa is a place to do business. If the Democrats win, that's fine. If the Republicans win, I don't think we are uncomfortable.
Despite relatively widespread support for the Democrats, there's also the belief that any change to Africa's benefit in American policy is unlikely to happen soon. Kofi Attoh from Ghana's main opposition party, the NDC.
The president in America is not fully in charge of the system, particularly if you have a Senate that is in the majority and you are in the minority, that type of thing. Left to him, he wants to do all this, but the monies have to be voted by Congress. It has to be disbursed. I don't see things changing tomorrow because Kerry has won or Bush has won again. It will take time, but we hope that there will be some positive passion towards Africa with the Democrats.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook in Accra, Ghana.
Next month's general election will have voters in California choosing the fates of 16 ballot measures on issues like stem cell research, emergency medical funds, mental health care, and open primaries. One of the closely watched initiatives on the California ballot is Prop 66, which would reform the infamous three strikes you're out law, the toughest in the U.S. Current law requires sentences to be doubled for any felony if the offender has one prior serious or violent felony conviction, or a 25-year life sentence for any felon with two prior serious or violent felony convictions. This situation has led to a bloated prison population, with around 42,300 people serving a double sentence or 25 years to life. If passed, Proposition 66 would require the state to re-sentence inmates whose third strike felony was non-violent. In addition, prison sentences for specified sex offenders against children would be strengthened. FSRN's Vinnie Lombardo examines the rhetoric and reality of Prop 66.
What three strikes does is target the most serious career criminals who commit the vast majority of crimes.
Brian Gerwitz, a deputy district attorney in Orange County, California, took a 12-week leave of absence so he could work for the campaign to defeat Proposition 66. He contends the three strikes law is an effective tool in keeping down California's crime rates and that the harsh sentencing guidelines are applied to only the most deserving offenders.
Three strikes targets recidivist, dangerous felons who have at least two serious or violent felonies in their background.
While Gerwitz concedes the three strikes law is faulty, he maintains that Prop 66 is not the fix, and if passed, more than 26,000 violent predators would be let loose onto California's streets.
It is beyond dispute that Proposition 66 would result in child molesters, murderers, and rapists getting out of prison.
The murderers, the rapists, they're not going to be released.
Irene Rodriguez, Northern California coordinator of Families to Amend California's Three Strikes, or FACTS, has a different take.
That's what they say, the floodgates are going to be let open and all these prisoners are going to be released. It's false. It's to scare the people. It's a scare tactic.
She says voters were misled by the same rhetoric 10 years ago, and now her son Ralph is among thousands of people stuck in what she refers to as an early grave, locked away in prison.
When the law was written in the beginning, it was definitely too wide of a net so that too many people could fall into it. And this is what happened, that people were getting put away for nonviolent crimes instead of violent crimes the way it was supposed to be in the first place, the way it was intended.
Earlier this month, the Justice Policy Institute, a nonprofit research group seeking alternatives to incarceration, issued the last installment of a three-part series examining the 10-year impact of California's Three Strikes Law. The report concludes that 65% of second and third strike prisoners were convicted of nonviolent crimes.
In California, the law is so broad that literally you can get a life sentence for what is a misdemeanor in other states.
Vincent Schiraldi is executive director of the Justice Policy Institute and co-author of the three reports. He points out that on a statewide basis, African Americans and Latinos are imprisoned under three strikes at far higher rates than their white counterparts, and says racial profiling, poverty, and access to competent attorneys are driving these discrepancies.
African Americans are locked up at 13 times the rate of whites, which is astonishing. And some of the county by county numbers are absolutely off the charts. In San Francisco, blacks are imprisoned for life under three strikes at 75 times the rate of whites. Latinos are imprisoned at 5 times the rate of whites. And I've been around this prison stuff for a long time. You almost never get to see those kinds of racial disparities.
With the election less than 2 weeks away, the latest opinion polls suggest that 65% of California voters are in favor of the reforms to the Three Strikes Law. Still, the measure's opponents say they are determined to defeat Proposition 66. Yet Schiraldi thinks their efforts could be better directed.
They should be pushing for better reentry programs so that when people do come out of prison, they come out in a way that assures our public safety and helps them turn their lives around.
In Santa Cruz, California, I'm Vinnie Lombardo for Free Speech Radio News.
While discussion of the country's increasing dependence on foreign fuel sources continues to dominate this year's election season, one alternative source got a big boost earlier this month. The grain-based fuel ethanol has become a renewable resource with a reputation for rural economic development, particularly in the Midwest. As part of a major tax bill passed the second week of October, the U.S. Senate included provisions that will boost the ethanol industry in Minnesota. While many environmentalists and farmers have lauded the move, others have decried it as a politicized gift to swing states. From Minneapolis, Carrie Byne and Kristen Lindstrom file this report.
Ethanol is an alcohol. It's the result of the fermentation of sugars. Man's earliest venture into biotechnology was figuring out how to make ethanol from grains, crops, sugars. Chemically, it's the same as the alcohol that might be in beer, wine, or spirits. I mean, you can drink it.
That's Bill Lee, general manager for the Chippewa Valley Ethanol Company. Based in Benson, Minnesota, near the South Dakota border, CVEC is a cooperative owned by about 950 local farmers. CVEC's ethanol is made from corn, about two-thirds of which comes directly from their shareholders. There are 13 other ethanol producers in the state, a result of the most vigorous ethanol state policy in the country. Provisions passed recently under an unrelated federal tax bill aim to strengthen this budding industry and have folks like Bill Lee feeling increasingly optimistic.
We think that here locally, we probably have impacted the local price at least 15 to 20 cents a bushel. And then you multiply what's going on here in Benson times the other 13 facilities in Minnesota, and you start to see that this has had a huge impact on the rural economy here in Minnesota.
In 1997, Minnesota became the only state in the country to mandate that ethanol be added to the state's gasoline. That mandate currently stands at 10%. In September of this year, Hawaii became only the second such state. As a result, says Minnesota's Democrat Senator Mark Dayton, nationwide ethanol use is only at about 2% per volume of gasoline.
And of course, the oil and gas lobby in Washington has done their utmost to poison people's minds out there about the repercussions. And in fact, ethanol is a cheaper fuel right now than regular gasoline. And it will, if we really start using ethanol as we could, mean a revitalization of rural America economically and socially that you couldn't do with all the government programs combined.
Minnesota has long been inadvertently hurt due to the government's process of awarding federal highway dollars based on gasoline consumption. A tax credit included in the bill will fix this gap, translating into about $1 billion for the state and potentially making future use of ethanol an easier choice for state officials. The bill will also extend a tax credit to cooperatives who had previously been considered ineligible. While these pork provisions are not actually part of the bill's focus, Senator Dayton says that the ethanol issues were enough to get him to support the bill.
Oh, it was a very major part of the balance in the equation because I see the ethanol as so crucial to any kind of alternative and better energy future for Minnesota and for the nation. This corporate tax bill, which had some good aspects to it but had a number of parts that were just outrageous, this was one of the good ones.
Not everyone agrees that the good outweighed the bad, particularly this close to a contentious presidential election. Josh Straka works for Minnesota Congresswoman Betty McCollum, who voted against the bill when it came through the House.
Basically, the Republican leadership took a bill that was intended to aid American manufacturers and protect jobs, and instead loaded it up with billions of dollars of special interest tax breaks and loopholes.
It's not that Congresswoman McCollum had not supported ethanol initiatives in the past, stresses Straka.
Unfortunately, with a provision like ethanol, it's important enough. It's an alternative fuel. It's a renewable fuel. We need to be addressing this in an appropriate bill and an appropriate measure. And we have those before Congress, and Congress has not acted.
Part of the country's currently unpassed energy bill includes a renewable energy standard, which would require each refiner to use a percentage of renewable fuel. CVEC's Bill Lee says that advocating for that standard will be one of his cooperative's top priorities in the upcoming year. With Kristen Lerstrom from KFAI in Minneapolis, this is Carrie Byron for Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.